Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Brenor.
And Devendra Hardawar will be joining us a little bit later for our main topic discussion on this week's show. The Jesus Phone version 5 descends to humanity and sales both break records and disappoint, depending on who you ask. Plus, iOS 6 maps. Did Apple jump the gun before they were ready? And did they have a choice? But first, this week's headlines. We're going to start with Nintendo. Nintendo has finally given hard details on its upcoming Wii U game console, with a U.S. launch date of November 18th and a base price of $300. The Wii U comes in two editions, a basic white version with 8 gigs of storage and a deluxe black version with 32 gigs of storage. The basic version will cost $300 and the deluxe version will run $350. It'll have a gig of RAM for game memory and a gig of RAM for system memory. And Wii U owners who own games from Wii's WiiWare and Virtual Console services can transfer those games to the new system. I don't know about you guys, but I have to admit I'm not as thrilled to rush out and get this the Wii U as I was with Nintendo's last console, the Wii.
I am in full agreement. And honestly, that says a lot because I'm a full-on Nintendo fanboy. I've never owned a game console that wasn't... Okay, I owned an Atari when I was a kid. But since that Atari, I've bought every single Nintendo product. And I mean, maybe I'm just older at this point, but like, I still play my Wii, you know, every other day or something, you know, for the titles.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I love my Wii. Like, I still play it. But like, I don't know, I just look at this thing and I'm like, Nintendo, what are you doing? Like, I don't even understand. Like, I mean, yeah, like, did you guys ever play the Game Boy Advance add-on to the GameCube?
It was an
extremely obscure update that basically allowed you to use your Game Boy Advance as a
controller.
As a controller,
right. It was only for like one or two games, right?
Exactly, Pac-Man and Crystal Chronicles.
Right, Crystal Chronicles. Okay. I remember Crystal Chronicles.
Did you guys ever have the body glove or the game glove or whatever it was called?
I did not.
I did.
Yeah, no, that sounds exact. What you're talking about sounds exactly like that.
Yeah, exactly. It was one of those really obscure things, and it was cool for those certain games, but it clearly didn't catch on. And I don't know. Like, I just feel like Nintendo is sort of obsessed with this idea. Mm-hmm. And has just sort of gone through with it. But it wasn't like an overwhelming experience, even on, you know, these games were specifically built for it. I don't know. It just seems like kind of a weird hack.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like overall the system is not as revolutionary an advance from the Wii as, say, like other consoles, like the PlayStation 2 to the PlayStation 3 is somewhat of a revolutionary advance. The Xbox 360, the Xbox to the Xbox 360 is somewhat of a revolutionary advance. This seems more iterative, and I'm not feeling like there's like with the content itself that there's any huge, other than the second screen aspect. The games themselves seem very kind of, very much the same as the previous version, as the previous console's games.
Yeah.
I just kind of feel like the iPhone 5 came out, the Wii U came out, which is the more enticing gaming platform, not the Wii U.
Yeah, but that's a great point there. I mean, I think that Nintendo got hit hard, particularly with handheld consoles, got hit hard by the fact that gaming has gone to smartphones. And
it's gone to smartphones, but also look at what else is out there. The PS Vita is a phenomenal device. I am not a console dude. I'm not. But I got to say, like, obviously the iPhone's really powerful. Android has really powerful things in it. A lot of the time on those devices, though, you don't get a lot of fine-tuned control because you have to do some tilting, you have to do some other stuff. It doesn't stop them from being great devices. But if you're a hardcore gamer, it's not the experience you're looking for. The PS Vita, phenomenal. And you know what? It's able to play some serious. It's able to pack some serious power in because it's a miniature version of some of the technology that you find on the PS3, which is 7 years old now. So they can miniaturize it to the point of the Vita. And I feel like that is a phenomenal mobile gaming platform that is more powerful in many ways than the Wii U, especially when you're looking at some of the graphics that are there. Is the Wii U great? Yeah, but it's also not touchscreen the way the Vita is. So I think Nintendo has something of a less interesting device here because if you're going to release in this paradigm, first of all, don't release first. We all know that from Sega. and second of all, when you look at what else is out there, it's just not – there's nothing compelling here yet. You know, it's just not phenomenal. They could have released a Wii HD and we would have been happy with that, maybe possibly happier than we are with the Wii U.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It just it's like what people really wanted was them to take what they currently had and upgrade it to like current generation hardware, make it an HD, make it, you know, have some of the multimedia things that we're used to thinking about in, you know, I mean, the Wii can't even play DVDs. Everything else can play DVDs.
Right.
The Wii, you have to hack. And the thing is, physically it can. Nintendo just
decided it wasn't important.
And there's still like no decent online experience that we know of.
Right.
I mean, you can get Netflix on it, but Netflix is only SD Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. I don't know. Nintendo is weird. Like half the time, they are like unbelievably innovative, almost like Apple-esque in terms of just like really doing visionary things like nobody else does. And then the other half of the time, I'm convinced they just spent too much time swimming in their giant like money pool. You know, because that's one of the problems that they have. They are sitting on literally Apple levels of cash reserves. They have, I think, like billions in cash reserves. Yeah. They could just like sit there and not do anything for a couple years and still keep everyone on salary. And that's great, you know, for their long-term job. And they need it, especially given that they're in the hardware business and they're one of the few companies out there besides Apple to turn a profit on their hardware. But at the same time, it just means that occasionally they do idiotic things because they just don't care, in my opinion.
They're not forward thinking. They're stuck in this mentality, in the Nintendo Entertainment System mentality, the NES mentality, and they've never really broken out of that. It's basically how can we continue to provide a service like the NES and not. Yeah. They don't think three-dimensionally into the future of gaming, unfortunately.
Well, one other thing I think that they've really missed out on, I think this is a little bit more subtle than the mobile one, but in terms of, I don't know, I feel like there's a new sort of form of gaming out there at the moment. Like, it used to be you had like the hardcore gamers and you had the casual gamers. Mm-hmm. And Nintendo like really Nintendo had a sort of interesting place there because all the hardcore gamers grew up playing Nintendo, but didn't really anymore because it was still sort of kiddish or whatever. But I feel like with the rise of mobile gaming and then with stuff like the Humble Indie Bundle, you're getting this sort of like hipster gamer, if I'm using a terrible term.
Indie and gamer, like, yeah.
And Nintendo would be perfect for that because Nintendo's like their titles that they're known for fall into that. They're fun, they're creative, they're playful, they're difficult, but they're not insane.
Yeah.
But the problem is like for whatever reason, like no one makes those games for the Nintendo platform. Nintendo could become like the hipster gamer platform, you know, for the Humble Indie Bundle and, you know, sort of the sort of stuff that I can't remember Journey and like Leaf, you know, that are currently all on the PlayStation. And they really like this would be the time when they really should like start courting like more of a developer. Actually starting to court developers like this. I feel like gone are the days where like you make all your money off of licensing your platform. Like you need to realize that like you're going to dominate the platform if you can get the most developers on it. And Nintendo basically is the only developer that develops in the Nintendo platform. And I think that that's a real detriment to their system. And it also is a detriment to, you know, in terms of this vision, because like they're never going to get other developers being like, oh, we have to develop a a game specifically for this platform and this platform only.
Well, part of that's also because the indie developer hasn't had a lot of success on consoles until very, very recently. So
yeah,
Nintendo could sit back and say, okay, well, we're going to let anyone and everyone design for our platform, which is the SDK. Go for it. They haven't done that, really. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, no one's really done that until very recently on the Xbox. If they can entice indie developers away from platforms like the Xbox, they might have a go at this. Or the iPhone, they might have a go at this Wii U thing. But, I mean, it all really depends on some level on what Apple wants to do with the Apple TV. They can move in that direction. And then we really box the likes of Nintendo out while keeping the hardcore gamers. Because what the problem there is that Nintendo is getting these hipster gamers, these casual gamers. And that's exactly what Apple's going for, too. So,
yeah.
All right, let's move on here. Google rejected a request by the White House last Friday to reconsider its decision to keep online a controversial YouTube movie clip that has ignited anti-American protests in the Middle East, according to Reuters. Google said it was censoring the video in India and Indonesia after blocking it on Wednesday in Egypt and Libya, where U.S. embassies have been stormed by protesters enraged over the depiction of the Prophet Muhammad as a fraud and philanderer. Google said they were further restricting the clip to comply with local law rather than as a response to political pressure. We've restricted access to it in countries where it's illegal, such as India and Indonesia, as well as Libya and Egypt, given the very sensitive situation in these two countries, they said. The approach is entirely consistent with principles we laid out in 2007. White House officials had asked Google earlier to reconsider whether the video had violated YouTube's terms of service. Google said that the video was within its guidelines. So let me ask you guys, considering the devastating global fallout from this video's release, should Google have pulled the video entirely from YouTube, or would violating their principles be worse in the long run?
They did the right thing. Turn it off where there are problems, right?
Mm-hmm.
The local law, like they work with local law. That's their policy. It's a good policy. Hey, local law says turn it off. We're turning it off. But this is America. And yes, people have died. Whether they're important people or not important people, the fact is Americans have died because of the WISP video. Mm-hmm. That's not on Google. That's on the people who killed them. It's not on the guys who made the video. It's on the people who killed them. We live in a country where this technology is available because we appreciate frank and open debate. We appreciate satire. We appreciate the ability to express ourselves as we want to. And yeah, that's not appreciated in other places, which is why they went and killed the ambassador and his aides and his staff and so on. But at the same time, we can't – those lives would have been in vain if we just turned it off. Just turning it off takes their sacrifice about what we believe in collectively as a country, what we agreed to by being citizens that lurk under the Constitution. And so I think Google's position is uncomfortable for many, but it is the correct decision ethically, legally, and morally.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to believe that if they were to remove the video entirely, that it would that would signal a slippery slope of censorship that they can't, that would end up in a lot of other basically it's the wrong move for them as a whole to set that precedent.
Especially when they've sort of stood up for free speech, like with the China thing a few years ago. And I don't know, sort of an easy opportunity for them to sort of maintain their, you know, we are the benefactor of the internet. You know, we are going to sort of keep this principle of speech on the internet is speech on the internet. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, we all are internet libertarians here, so I don't think we're going to have much disagreement. But I don't know. I'm more concerned almost by the fact that the government is asking private corporations to, you know, take these things
right.
down.
Right. That's an excellent point.
But, I mean, that's getting into less of a technological discussion, more of a political conversation. But that's as far as I'll go with that.
I mean, like, it's interesting because you think about WikiLeaks and the government chasing down the guys in charge of that because of like state secrets and, you know, guys going to jail and things like that
for letting that out. So they want that down. The government is also asking to take, but the government's also asking to take this thing down, which is, you know, it's the property of someone that they've licensed to YouTube to put out there. And Chris said, call us government libertarians. I gotta agree with that. Internet libertarians, yeah, rather. Yeah, we're not government libertarians.
I'm not sure what that would mean. The government, yeah, exactly, should have the freedom to do whatever it wants.
It was without the government, yeah. But the idea is that, you know, like, I think the government is – it's politically, I think the government's not able to say, well, we asked them to take it down. But at the same time, like, where's the backbone? Like, the government – you know, like, that's a weird thing for a freedom-loving government to say, you know?
Yeah.
Make a statement about the tragedy. Make a statement about how it's unfortunate that people can't understand this level of freedom. And I mean, people are seeing this as a religious slur.
Right.
There are plenty of religious slurs all over the internet about Christianity. You don't see, and you know, every once in a while we'll find a Christian fundamentalist that'll, like, you know, do Waco or blow up an abortion clinic or whatever. I just feel like it's the prime example of why theology should not be running your country. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, a country is best served by people who have independent thought, and this is clearly an example of that. And yeah, I'm a raging super internet libertarian, but at the same time, a really frank and open debate is what allows these technologies to exist in the first place. Technologies that, frankly, many of these countries benefit from. So this is crazy.
All right. On a lighter note, and because we always like to follow up a story about Muslim rage with a story about bacon, Google.
Aww. Whoa. That was a little.
On Yom Kippur, too, no less.
I know. I mean, that's a little. Yikes.
Google has introduced a new search operator to their stable of searches, and that is a tool that calculates the connections between actors and actresses and the most famous actor never to have been nominated by an Academy Award, or as we know it, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, which is, of course, a variation of the 6 degrees of separation, which posits that everyone in the world is no more than 6 acquaintance links from anyone else on Earth, or in this case, the shortest path between any arbitrary actor and Kevin Bacon. To use it, you type in the words Bacon number without quotes, followed by an actor or actress's name, and Google will come back with how closely he or she has been to Kevin Bacon. I don't know if you guys had a chance to try this out.
I played around with it a little bit. It does what you would expect.
Yeah.
It's kind of an odd feature.
Yeah.
I like Google's continual whimsicalness. And honestly, I think it displays some pretty impressive, like, you know, technology to sort of have that sort of semantic understanding of, like, the fact that it's an actor and the fact that it was in, you know, that actor was in this movie. Like, that's a, I don't know, it's kind of a cool sort of much more semantic in Google search than just sort of like pattern matching or, you know, whatever. It sort of shows just how far they've come in terms of the semanticness of their search since a decade ago when we first discovered them.
They have this wonderful whimsical side. I love that about Google. And I love, and also it's this particular search is an incredibly challenging one. Like, I haven't been able to see a Bacon number search over 4, for example. Everyone seems to be connected to Kevin Bacon on a level of 3 or less. So
yeah, that's what's right. I mean, it's essentially the traveling salesman problem. It's very reminiscent of a number of important sort of pathfinding computer science algorithms. And given the number of movies and the number of actors out there, it's really impressive that they have the computing resources to solve these problems in real time. You know, these are pretty difficult because you're basically essentially trying to find a path amongst this huge, ridiculous web of, you know, actors and actresses. This is really cool. Good old Kevin Bacon.
Well, I mean, guys, Siri just came out in iOS 6 with the ability to track down actors, movies, all that stuff. I feel like this is something that that is in direct, you know, a competition with it. I don't know if the timing is
if the timing is like, you know, one of those things that's a real thing, it's just a coincidence or whatever. But I feel like Apple and Google both offering the same similar products at the same time. Although Google's is way funnier, and you don't have the trouble to fight with Siri to get your answers.
Right.
You know.
Let's move on here. So Steve Ballmer has been pretty outspoken about how his company was going to use its new Surface tablet to turn up the heat on Apple, but he's been pretty tight-lipped about how much it expects its Surface to cost until now. Noting that we haven't announced pricing, Ballmer said during an interview with the Seattle Times that if you look at the bulk of the PC market, it would run between, say, probably $300 to about $700 or $800. That's the sweet spot.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the I think most of the analysts have looked at that and been like, eh, it's probably going to be on the upper end of that.
Right. Well, but there's two different models. So you think maybe he could be referring to about $300 for the – yeah.
If they actually can get a $300 price point or sub $500 for their lower-end model, I think that'll be pretty good.
I've got some information that says it's going to be about the cost of an entry-level iPad for the lower model, and it's going to be about the cost of a reasonable laptop for the model that is basically a laptop. Like, I really want to be clear. The Surface is an amazing device because it's not just a tablet. And I don't want to use the word just a tablet as to diminish tablets out there. Mm-hmm. When I say tablets, I mean iPad. I love my iPad. It's a great device. It's dedicated to what it's doing. It's a mobile operating system on a big screen, and it really gets it done. No doubt about that. But the Surface is trying to do something different, which is taking a different tack to the technology. And it is in many ways more advanced than the iPad. Whether it will take off or not, we don't know. But it is in many ways more advanced, and you have to pay for that advancement. And if Microsoft is smart and they're still sticking to their guns with their enterprise friends, then I think they don't have to worry too much about keeping it slightly – like charging – the premium that it is, because you can get to the file system in the real version. You can do this. You can do that. You can do things that, frankly, annoy people like you, me, and Chris and Davinja about the iPad. So I think that it's not something that needs to be. It can be expensive, I think.
And people will be okay with that.
People that they're going for, they're not going after the iPad people. Right, like for instance, if Microsoft were to leave this in the hands of HP, HP would design it to look as much like an iPad, or Samsung would design it to look as much like an iPad as possible,
right,
and attack it. But Microsoft's like, no. They've done a fundamentally different thing with the Metro/Windows 8 UI. A fundamentally different thing.
Sure.
They haven't put a fork on top of Android to make it look like iOS. And they've done a fundamentally different thing when it comes to the hardware. Yes, it's a tablet. Mm-hmm. It is their second go at tablets. Let's be also clear. Microsoft got into the tablet game a long time ago, and the Panasonic Toughbook tablets actually saw serious usage. Did they see iPad usage? Absolutely not. But they were great business applications for them. So I really feel like they are an original company with an original idea that they didn't trust anybody else to make, and I think that that's going to cost money. And also the courier that we all mourn that's gone now, that never made, that would have not been a $500 device. Like, I mean, you look at what that device entailed. Yeah. That was at least $800 out the gate, with the two screens and the touch this and all that other stuff like that. And this device isn't that, but in some ways, it's a full size. It's a full computer. With SSD, and all that, and like crazy amounts of RAM and everything, running a desktop OS and a tablet OS in a platform form factor, that's not a chintzy product. You know, that's a high quality product. So
yeah, I think the problem we're seeing with Microsoft these days is that, like, I mean, Microsoft is really, honestly, I feel like since 2007 when they introduced the ribbon interface in the 2007 Office, they are really innovating and they really are pushing forward interface and interaction computer in a really different way than they have before. I think their problem is that they're a little bit sort of divided amongst themselves between, like, their sort of like business backwards compatibility enterprise stuff and their desire to sort of move things forward, and the fact that for the first time they're not really in the sort of market dominance they used to be. Like, it used to be, if you wanted a computing device, you used Windows on a desktop or a laptop. And I mean, like, my parents use their Kindles or their iPads or their, you know, sort of other computing device for sort of casual computing. And they can't sort of sway the market in the same way that they used to. But yeah, I think they're still sort of trying to. And they've been really, really, really obnoxious to the developer community. And most developers who find themselves sort of traditionally in the Windows world I know of are extremely frustrated by Microsoft's like, oh, we're using this toolkit now. Oh, nope, that toolkit is out of date. We're using this other thing now. Like every couple of years, they keep changing it. And especially in the Windows community, the Windows Phone developer community, like, I don't know what they're thinking. They're trying to get developers to get good applications on their phone, and yet they keep switching, you know, the entire toolkit, which sort of pisses off the developers and says, okay, well, I learned that, and I have to learn this other thing. If I'm going to learn this other thing, why don't I learn Xcode and start making iOS development on a known market with a known phone? I don't know. I think they have much more sort of social problems at this point than innovation problems, because they clearly are coming up with some really cool stuff. I love the Metro interface. I really wish I actually tried when I had my Android phone to see if I could install a Metro interface for Android, because I really liked it that much. But
it almost feels like because they're in this market that's currently dominated by Apple, that they almost have to come in at a more competitive price in order to even break even or gain any sort of traction on an already established market.
Yeah, they're going to have to come in with a really compelling price point, or else they're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like they're not. I mean, obviously they want consumers on this, but it, you know, demographically speaking, I don't think it's meant to appeal to all the same people. There's a lot of overlap here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fundamentally different device, and I think that it's the kind of thing where if they can't hit those numbers, they may not hit them this time. But it's all about, you know, it's the first generation of the product, so Surface 2 might be where they want to go, that kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like, obviously, $500 for a tablet, an entry level tablet, a good 10-inch entry level tablet, that's good mojo. You can't beat that. And even, you know, Apple can barely beat that. Now they've got the $400 version of the iPad 2 that's out there. I just really think that what we're looking at here is, as much as we want to compare it to the iPad, I feel like it's something a little different. And in many ways, it's more powerful, especially because it's compatible with the dominant computing system in the world. And I think that's something that people are going to have to pay for.
They've created Microsoft with the Surface. I feel like they've created this haute couture device. But in order to succeed, they have to sell it at a ready-to-wear price. And if they don't, then
that's the Samsungs and the HPs and the Dells are. That's their job, right?
Right, right, right.
So that's not though the Apple paradigm at Microsoft. Yeah, they're making a device, and it is haute couture. I like that analogy, Andy. I think it's completely astute. I mean, really, it's a great one. Microsoft is going to lay that out. They're going to lay out this haute couture strategy. And it's up to the other guys who are going to pick this up, who need to pick this up. I mean, HP's already – they've come out with a slate. They're about to come out with a slate that was nowhere near touch-optimized as this device is going to be. And they're going to be their job to sell at a price that people will move at, because that's what they
– Can I make an observation about about sort of the general electronics market that seems increasingly clear? Like, so we have a whole number of people moving into new sort of hardware – platforms recently. We have Apple moving into the tablet market. We have Microsoft moving into the tablet market. Google moving into the phone and tablet market. And it seems like, by and large, as awesome as Toshiba and Samsung and Dell and HP and all these giant electronic manufacturing companies are, they're kind of like sheep. Like, you have to, like, if you have a vision for what a computing device is and needs to be, like, you need to build it yourself. Because, as you said, Dwayne, like, otherwise they're just going to go out and copy whatever the dominant thing is. Like, oh, we're just going to make an iPhone look alike, or an iPad look alike. And if you want to make something that really, like, moves the industry forward, and especially if you're somebody like Google or Microsoft and your brand is going to be all over it, then you really need to step up and do it yourself, because the OEMs or the manufacturers are just going to sort of produce lots of variations on the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on here to our last headline of the before we get into our main topic. Last week, Twitter CEO Dick Costolo unveiled a new design for its entire platform on the Today Show. Twitter.com's new changes borrow heavily from Facebook, adding a cover photo for profiles, a photo stream, and a useful Discover tab. It seems like Facebook's cover photo, the large photo that appears behind your profile photo, appears to be the new standard for social media sites. Google Plus recently added cover photos after Facebook did. The changes to the Twitter mobile apps aren't drastic, but they do add a lot of functionality.
They also limit functionality.
How so?
You can't, like, if you're looking at your screen and you see a link in there, you can't just click on the link in your screen. You have to click on the tweet. The tweet has to open up, and then and only then can you click your link, things like that.
Right.
There's an article on the diminished functionality of the new
Twitter.
They've
also really, really been cutting back the API. I mean, to the point where
Tumblr got
removed from their API. Like, Tumblr can't use it for Discovery anymore.
That's a whole different conversation. That's a whole episode. That's,
you know, did we talk at all about Peter Thiel's entrepreneurship class at Stanford this past spring? I can't remember.
You brought it up a couple times.
Yeah, so he has a really important observation there, which it seems like just about every company in the world is making the mistake on. Like, when you're a business and you attack another business at their core, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to ever actually take them over at their core. I mean, getting away from technology, Burger King will be forever known as the second place thing to McDonald's. Pepsi will always be the second place to Coca-Cola because they're competing on the other brand's defining characteristic. You know, Starbucks can actually compete with McDonald's because they're not seen as a direct competitor. They're attacking them obliquely, and they're getting a dominant sort of place in the market by finding the thing that they're really good at, i.e. coffee, and really dominating at that. And the problem I'm seeing with these technology companies these days is everyone has this desire to be what everyone else is. Like Twitter, instead of seeing the ways that Twitter is extremely unique and, you know, very powerful in its own right, looks at what Facebook and Google Plus are doing and we've got to do that now. We got to have profiles. We got to have, you know, a cover photo. Like, we need to have more of this sort of Facebooky type experience rather than being a distributed platform for instant communication.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is just really sort of sad because it just seems like there's so much more that they could have done with it. And instead, they're just going to be known as, that thing that's kind of like Facebook, except you can't post as many pictures.
Well, I don't know if I agree with you completely. MySpace was out before Facebook. MySpace fell to Facebook. Apple made telephones after Palm and Rim. Both of those companies are gone or nearly gone. I don't think it's true that if you attack someone on their playing field that you'll always be the second. Look at the iPod.
To move away from Apple.
Yeah. You've also got things like Subway versus Blimpy. Blimpy was around first. Subway took them out, that kind of thing. So all I'm saying is that there are cases where people can get in and get under. And the social media space has been consistently one of those cases. Friendster to MySpace to Facebook, you know, and maybe Twitter is the next thing. Maybe Google Plus is the next thing. We don't know. Search is the same way. Google attacked on search. Where is Lycos? Where is Excite? Where is Alta Vista? They're all dead.
Yeah.
I think that your argument about when it comes to technology, it doesn't apply at all, especially in
there always has to be somebody attacking the number one person in the market. But I don't know. I feel like
what happened to Garmin, man. Garmin, TomTom, their stock dropped by 15% in 2010.
But the thing is, in all those cases, the person coming up from behind was either totally not in that market at all, or they were usually much more often, except for the Apple cases, they were a startup that took on the sort of established. They weren't a big company moving into another big company's.
But I mean, that's the Facebook case. Facebook was a startup that took out MySpace. MySpace was
exactly
a took out Friendster. But when you look at what happened, Google was a huge company that took out Garmin. So I just don't see that argument there. But that aside,
I do think that what Twitter's doing is really interesting considering what's happened to Facebook in terms of their value. Twitter is making these moves. You mentioned the API stuff, and I'd really like, if we could have a conversation about that next week, I'd really like to get into it because I'd love to know as a developer how you feel about it in depth. But you know, Twitter is attacking, you know, Twitter is attacking the developers on that side, as is Facebook. And then you've also got these situation where Facebook, it's still struggling to find value. It's going to have a great amount of value with Facebook Exchange, but it's still struggling to find where its value point sits. And as Twitter struggles possibly even more with that, think about what Twitter's already accomplished. The Green Revolution in Iran, Twitter. The Library of Congress. Facebook isn't in the Library of Congress, but Twitter is. You know, like, these are big social accomplishments that a social network really has taken, like, done. And Twitter's use on mobile is phenomenal. You know, it definitely beat Facebook on mobile hands down for years and years and years. I don't know where it sits now, but I know, you know, Twitter was is just excellent that way. So it's interesting to see that Twitter wants to move in a Facebook-like direction where in many ways they've been ahead of the Facebook curve. They've been so differentiated. That's why we say Twitter and Facebook, Facebook and Twitter, because they're in the social sphere, but they're very different products, which is why they've become so powerful. So I think it's really strange. It's bizarre that Twitter would do these things to make themselves more like Facebook, unless they're trying to gain incremental growth from the actual Facebook user. Now, we've also seen statistically that Twitter is where the children are going. The kids are going to Twitter because grandma's on Facebook. You know, Facebook had this big growth between people the ages of 20, 35 to 45 years old over the last 2 years, and Twitter's growth is clearly linked to the youthful people. So maybe they're trying to like do that too. I don't think we have enough data to really say, but I just know that it's like, I agree that it's really strange and weird. Go ahead.
I wonder if maybe they're trying to capitalize on Facebook's difficulty with mobile. I mean, Twitter was originally conceived as a mobile application. I mean, remember the whole reason why there's a 140 character limit is because it was supposed to be sent from text messages. Yep. Via your phone. And so I think Twitter realizes, you know, if Facebook is floundering a little bit on their move to mobile, then that's an opportunity for Twitter to sort of really pick up those advertisers. And I wonder if, you know, obviously a lot of this stuff is much more about controlling the way that you interact with Twitter. And let's face it, that's primarily because Twitter is about brands, i.e. their personal brands, like celebrities, or corporate brands like Comcast Cares, that care a lot about their presentation, and it's about displaying ads into the stream. And, you know, they need to control that. I don't know, the profile stuff just seems a little bit more silly. Oh, I guess I sort of understand. You know, it's always been a little bit difficult to sort of like, you know, put a nice looking background image or something onto your page because you have no idea what the resolution is going to be. So you basically can either have like a dumb looking tiling pattern or a extremely giant full image. And I think something like the timeline sort of panorama on the back would be nice to sort of be able to have your image on your page without like having to have like a giant, like 7 megabyte image that covers your entire screen. And that's pretty, you know, fairly important if you're a brand. But I don't know. It's sort of an odd move, in my opinion. And also, when is Twitter going to go public? Like, they've...
Well, no, they're not going to go public for a while. What happened to Facebook and what happened to Groupon?
Yeah, I know.
For them to go public. Like, let's get away from this going public situation. The average... Not the average, but many startups are looking to be purchased for, like, that big number, that big $300 million number, rather, or in Twitter's case, it's worth $1 billion, probably.
But Twitter's not going to get purchased, but they're way too big.
They may be way too big. I mean, I think that they got too big for that purchase number. People didn't really see the value. People didn't understand it. It's pretty abstract. But I think they're in a place where going public isn't going to help. They already have enough trouble with their current investors to have to even think about dealing with major shareholders.
Oh, I know, yeah.
You know, like it's not a business decision that would make a lot of sense for that company right now. They are in a growing pain situation. They are in a murky middle situation. Yeah. No doubt about that.
That's what I mean. Like, it just sort of feels like they're sort of beyond that stage where they're not going to be able to get any – like, there are very few VCs out there who would give them – enough money right at this point. I mean, they're huge at this point. They're not going to grow that much more.
VCs, and
control, and they don't want to give that. There's no one who can afford that control. You have to pay for control. That's why.
Yeah, and no one's going to buy them out either. So it just sort of seems like, well, they got to sort of do something at this point. They can't just, you know, I think they're really sort of pushing their monetization. That then is obviously very clear. I mean, they're obviously a very important social company, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. The question is whether or not they can monetize it, or whether it's something that sort of works much better like email. And there, you know, there's app.net. I don't know if we covered that on the show. And a couple of other attempts to sort of make distributed systems that function a lot more like email, but yet sort of have Twitter's, you know, stream type model.
Right, but there's various sorts of problems with all of those alternatives.
Sure.
You know, Twitter, unfortunately, is still the lesser of many evils in those respects. But I like the fact that there is some sort of competition out there that represents, you know, a move away from just the monopolization of the space. Before we get into our major topics, I want to talk briefly about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook that I'd like to recommend this week is The Life of Pi by Yann Martell. Have either of you guys ever read this book?
Oh, I love that book.
I actually haven't read it.
Life of Pi is absolutely on the list.
I actually haven't read it. Is it like a Paulo Coelho book, like The Alchemist, or any? Is it like one of those things? That's kind of how I felt. I mean, judging a book by its cover, absolutely.
It's very unique. It's like nothing else I've ever read. Well, it reminds me, I don't know, almost like The Little Prince, maybe. Like,
yeah. I have to say, I'm about three quarters of the way through. I'm not entirely finished with it. But yeah, you're dead on the money in that respect. I think it's not a complicated story, and it's told in a way that where the descriptions are very kind of visceral. They're very visceral and very there's not a lot of over analysis to the description of what's going on in the story. It's more about how the main character, it's told in first person, how the main character feels. Essentially, it's about a kid who, an Indian boy who is raised in a zoo. And when his father decides to move the family to Canada and sell the animals to American zoos, everyone gets on board this cargo ship, this Japanese cargo ship. The ship sinks, and the 16-year-old kid finds himself alone on a lifeboat with a hyena, an orangutan, a zebra with a broken leg, and a 450-pound Bengal tiger. And soon it's
like
just...
you're telling us too much about this book.
No, well, that's what's on the back.
That's crazy.
That's the back cover of the book. I know. It's just like, okay, that's the premise.
Soon,
then the book is what happens after that.
Right. Pretty soon it's just the kid, the tiger, and the vast Pacific Ocean for 227 days. And that's just basically the setup for the tale. And it's a great tale so far. I have to say that I'm enjoying it a lot. This was a bestseller for a while, and I'm just barely starting to pick it up myself after not having a chance to read it after all these years of it being a bestseller. But as is with most books that I read, that you know, what spurred this on was the fact that there's a movie adaptation coming up. In this case, director Ang Lee is has got a movie adaptation of this coming out soon, and so I'm like, I know I'm going to see this because I rarely ever miss an Ang Lee movie, so I better bone up on the book before I read it.
Yeah, it's a sort of book that you really should read. Like, I have no idea. I'm sure Ang Lee will do a wonderful job with the movie, but it's one of those things where, like, even if the movie is spectacular, the book still needs to be read as a book.
Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely right, because there's a lot of great stuff in the beginning about comparative religions. Like, the boy, Pi, explores a lot of comparative religions, which ends up being like this point of upheaval in his household, in the strictly Hindu household, even though they're not really that devout, they're not orthodox Hindus. their Hindi, I should say. They're, it's still the fact that he's exploring all these other comparative religions and is pretty and is fairly devout in each of them is a sense of upheaval. But it informs the how he deals with his situation when he gets stranded after this shipwreck. But anyway, it's a terrific book. You can that book as or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles can be yours for going to all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. If you don't like the book after your 30-day trial, you can – I mean, if you don't like the service, you can still keep the book. And so, yeah, that's it. We're going to take a little break here, play a little music, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Devinder Hardwar, and we're going to talk about the Apple iPhone 5 launch and iOS 6 maps and all of the craziness that ensues therein with that. So
can I just say one thing about that whole Apple iPhone 5? This is clearly a joke because you and Devinder and Chris are going to make fun of me because remember I was saying it's not necessarily the iPhone 5 the whole time? The one thing I want to say about it is that the iPhone 4 came out with an A4 processor as the fourth iPhone ever on iOS 4.
Right.
The iPhone 5 came out, right?
Yeah.
On an A6 processor as the sixth iPhone that ever came out on iOS 6. That's all I'm saying.
They wanted to avoid the six.
I think this is one of those cases like the hot dog buns and the hot dogs where you have to buy, you know, like 20 packs of hot dogs in order to even up with the packs of buns that you have to buy because they're, you know, eight hot dogs to a pack and 10 hot dog buns to a pack.
I'm just saying. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I totally do. I think by the time we reach the iPhone 21, we'll finally be evened up with the A21 processor. You know, we'll be even out. It'll be the nomenclature will make sense.
I guess so.
Anyway, take a listen to this and come on back.
Double D, big four breast on my baby. Triple A, couldn't wait the love I got for the girl. And I just wanna know. Why you ain't been going to work? Boss ain't working you like this. He can't take care of you like this. Now you're lost, lost in the heat of it all. Girl, you know you're lost, lost in the thrill of it all. Miami, Amsterdam, Tokyo, Spain, lost. Los Angeles, India, lost on a train, lost. Lost, lost, lost.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Christopher Brenor, and we are now joined by Devinder Hardwar for our discussion of the Apple iPhone 5 launch and iOS 6 and all of the associated madness that goes with that. Mm-hmm. So,
madness, really?
Madness.
So as
I don't know about madness, but okay.
As expected, Apple's newest iPhone has broken sales records previously set by the iPhone 4S as a result of the strong demand that the company saw from pre-order sales. Apple said that the iPhone 5 pre-orders had topped 2 million in the first 24 hours, which is more than double the record set by the iPhone 4S last year.
How does it compare to the record set by the Samsung Galaxy S3?
By the way, it's not double the iPhone 4S's thing. Over the weekend, this one got the iPhone 5 got 5 million. Last year, it was 4 million for the 4S.
Yeah.
So it's actually below many analyst estimates. Right. People were estimating between 6 to 10 million sales.
If they had released this phone last year, it would have been unstoppable. I think it was the phone that many people were waiting for. And I think that's like one of the reasons why there's this idea. I mean, John Gruber would, of course, disagree with me. But there's this idea of relative disappointment in the device because it doesn't seem like it's that much of a landmark compared to what's currently available from the 4S.
So there's a couple of different sort of mindsets involved in that. Some people say that a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's disappointment about...
Yeah, it's all stock. Like, I think it's pretty... You know, they just couldn't keep up with it. So people, they would have sold more if they had more to sell. I think that's kind of what it ended up being.
They should tell you numbers about orders. Because if you can continue to order it, that should be really what it comes down to, as opposed to like how much you have in stock. That's, I think, that really the estimate, the way we should be looking at it.
I don't know about that, because when we complain about, you know, shady numbers from companies, right, do we complain about orders actually made or orders that are actually, you know, shipped to customers?
I think the orders taken is really what comes down to, because when you look at the actual sales, like, for instance, video games, right, obviously different from mobile phones, but video game pre-order, it's money in the bank. So if Apple has money in the bank based on the fact that people want this device and they'll be waiting for it, that's something to be said. Kickstarter, it's all about how many people order this stuff before.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily money in the bank, right? If your thing isn't shipping for several weeks, are you getting charged fully when you make the order?
Yeah, because they also have to do the accounting for
it's a commitment. Exactly. I mean, it depends on, some credit cards do a hold. Some systems just charge you the money. Amazon doesn't charge you until it ships. That kind of thing. But I know when I got my 4S, you know, I didn't get charged until it shipped. But it was a commitment. I wasn't going to, like, pull it back or anything like that.
Yeah, but it's not about you, Dwayne. It's about the shareholders. And it's about what Apple has to report for its quarter, which ends this weekend.
So one thing I know a little bit. My wife is going to school for accounting right now. And I know that one thing, the reason why they might not do that, Dwayne, is because, like, it's money in the bank. But if they're going to count your – if they're going to count your money in for paying it, then they have to count your money, their money out for producing it. And they might not want to necessarily take on that cost for this quarter if they haven't actually spent it yet, make it look like they're spending more than they actually have.
I'm not talking about that in terms of revenue. I'm not asking about revenue. I'm asking about straight up orders. That's what I'm asking. That's what I'm talking about. So, Chris, you're right. When it comes to revenue spend, like, you know, what is your spend versus what is your gross margin? I understand that. What I'm saying is I think it's not illegitimate to look at the numbers of orders, of pre-orders, of orders on back order or whatever, the aggregate number of orders, and have a pretty good idea. I mean, maybe it's not gospel, but have a pretty good idea of what the demand is for a device, which is really what we're talking about here. We're talking about the human demand for a device that people have been waiting for quite some time. I mean, that's the actual thing that we're looking for, and I feel like that's the best way to determine, you know, what.
I do think that it's pretty clear in my opinion. I mean, this is, I mean, Gruber notwithstanding, I mean, they broke all the sales records, and they, I mean, this is not exactly a landmark sort of release like some of the other ones. I mean, it's definitely better. I think there was an expectation that because like the 3 to the 3GS was or the original to the 3G was a fairly big upgrade, and then the 4 was a fairly big upgrade, and the 4S wasn't as big of an upgrade. So I think there was a hope that with the sort of 5 update, there was going to be a major sort of update in terms of like form, you know, whatever. And it seems like this one is slightly bigger.
Pencil and form factor is the big deal, I think. I mean, obviously it's bigger, but it's not like they're not bigger phones out there. Obviously it's faster, but it's not like the 4S speed is painful. And they're in this kind of murky middle where, yeah, it's a different device. It's clearly a different device. But is it different enough to kind of stir the masses and get the kind of crazy hype? It would have been last year. It certainly wasn't this year.
Well, what do you think about the idea that the kind of the general slump in sales has something to do with the fact that overall people are less excited about, like, the excitement about smartphones in general is declining? Like,
there's no slump in sales. What slump in sales? I'm not trying to be an Apple apologist here. It's just they broke their records. It's not as much as some people were assuming. But also, I think they either overestimated how much Apple could make, or Apple, you know, kind of overestimated that figure as well.
We used to talk about this back on the Symbiotic podcast. I mean, like, Apple's very secretive about what it expects. And so the market is very bad at estimating what Apple's going to do. Like, Apple always has this problem where they're under or overestimating, or they're under or overperforming what the market expects. And in both cases, the market doesn't really like that. The market, even when they overperform, the market's like, well, gee, it would have been nice to know that. And I think that's just sort of the way Apple does its business. Like, they are going to sell a lot of stuff and they'll make a lot of money off of it. And,
well, I think they're, I mean, I don't think it's that simple. Like, for instance, the thing about this phone, I mean, Andy talks about the 3G versus the 3GS. So the original iPhone was really expensive and no one owned it. And everyone knew, a lot of the people came out saying there's a new one coming out. The 3GS was a redesign, which was a big deal. I mean, the 3G was a redesign, which was a big deal. But it didn't have any different hardware in it but the 3G antenna. Good enough for downloading apps, fine. It was fast for us at the time. 3GS comes out, and basically under the hood, it's a completely different device. That's why it still exists today, even though they just stopped selling it. How many 3GSs are on the market? The 4 comes out, complete redesign, Apple-made chip, new features, Retina display. You know, it's got the, it's gotten rid of the plastic. It's a whole new beast. The 4S came out, and it wasn't. I mean, it's not that different. It's a marginal change. And the fact is, even though it's a dual-core chip, it was running at 800 megahertz, which means it didn't necessarily feel crazy fast compared to the 1 gigahertz A4 chip. When you get to the 4S, it's really, I think, a phone that many people had been thinking was going to happen before. Add to that the fact that the iPhone 5, that's what I meant, as the phone that many people thought they were having for. The iPhone 5 and the iPhone 4S don't have a big differentiating factor in terms of a software software limitation. So, like, the iPhone 4 and the iPhone 4S is always going to be controversy. Could Siri have worked on the iPhone 4? People have hacked it, and it has worked, all that kind of stuff. There's no feature that the iPhone 5 has in terms of, you know, with the exception of, like, seeing more icons that the iPhone 4S doesn't have. And, I mean, at least right now. It might be, there might be something coming out, you know, later in a point release or whatever. But for right now, I feel like there's not a lot. There's no compelling thing to say, man, I really got to get rid of this 4S and go for this this iPhone 5. Everybody who has an iPhone 4 will probably rush up and try to get an iPhone 5 because, you know, their upgrade is ready and everything. But it's not the same. It doesn't have the same weight that has been happening before that. And Andy was saying, you've got the situation where many people are like, oh, I'm not excited about smartphones. There's also the fact that, I mean, what can you really, like, at this point, there's going to be a bit of plateauing because there's not a lot to be done. I mean, NFC, inductive charging, those are maybe big ticket items that Apple failed on this time. But I think for the most part, they delivered a solid device. It just was more like the evolutionary as opposed to revolutionary device. And I think that's where some of the perception of disappointment comes from.
Yeah, these smartphone updates are beginning to feel an awful lot more like the Mac. It's like, oh, there's a new Mac that came out. That's cool. It's got some new features. It's faster. It's got bigger numbers. It looks slightly different. But it's not like a revolution what it means to be a laptop anymore. It's just, I don't know. I mean, I hate to say, oh, you know, they've reached the end, because, of course, the whole thing that keeps technology going is that people are constantly redefining and constantly coming up with new things. I mean, that's, I think, why some cases, like, you know, we should realize that, you know, there's only so many changes you can make, and after a while, like, these devices do become part of our everyday lives, and so it's not as exciting. At the same time, like, Apple's business is constantly surprising us and bringing out new things, and we would, you know, like to be surprised. Part of Apple's overwhelming, not just Apple, but Google, and primarily Google and Apple's overwhelming success in smartphones, is they took smartphones from being something, you know, very sort of corporate and boring despite, you know, their amazing features, and they turn it into something very everyday. And so as a consequence, I feel like these features are being, these launches feel more like laptop refreshes. You know, no one gets that excited when they come out with a new version of the MacBook Pro. It's like, oh, there's a new MacBook Pro. It looks pretty much like MacBook Pros have looked for the last decade.
And they've also gotten a little less tight on, like, the secrecy has become a little less tight. So, like, the MacBook Pro or Retina display, we didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but we knew there was going to be a 15-inch MacBook Air-type computer. We were hoping for Retina. When it came to the iPhone 5, how long were these mock-ups, I mean, these proper, like pieces and proper mock-ups and all these other proper pieces, they were out for so long that So you know, with the iPhone 4, the pictures were out, but we didn't believe it. I sat on the Symbiotic podcast with you, with Chris and DaVinci. Like, it clearly is an app. Look at all those scenes. It's so weird. They would never do that.
So much for doubling down on secrecy, according to Tim.
I don't know. I wouldn't worry too much about the secrecy thing. I mean, like, it feels like every launch that comes out, people know something is coming. Like, everyone knew the iPhone was going to be launched when the iPhone was launched, and everyone knew that the iPad was going to be launched when the iPad was launched. People, you know, we all sat in and watched it. It's like, I don't know. I feel like, honestly, the thing that I'm most disappointed about this whole launch is I am waiting for Apple TV to get its refresh. You know, that's the big thing. And there have been a couple of other sort of like long-term things that Apple has sort of hinted at, and just sort of sitting here being like, oh, it's a more different iPhone is sort of a little bit disappointing when you have Steve Jobs saying, you know, on his deathbed, we fixed TV.
Right.
There's a lot of hype around the device and around how it looked, and I think we really got a lot of information that was actually accurate about the device. And I mean, that's going to happen when you have to create as many devices as they created. But a lot of the surprise stuff wasn't there this time. So I think all these things are lending to the device. Now, when you get to touch the actual device, it's a nice phone. It's a really nice phone. It's got the familiarity when it comes to getting your hand around it. For my part, it's a little difficult to, like, for instance, you're in the mail app. You want to scroll from one message to the other using the two arrow buttons at the top. It's more difficult because you have to slide it down in your hand now because it's bigger. Will I get over it? Absolutely. Is it a problem? Not really. If you're nitpicking, that you can go there. It's nice to have extra icons. It's nice to be able to have less pages of apps because you have that row of icons. It looks great. The colors are noticeably better than the 4S, which for a guy like me who, you know, can't really tell the difference between 1080p and 720p, that says something. So as devices go, I wouldn't hesitate to say it's one of the best smartphones you could buy today. Not hands down. It is a great device. I love playing with it. I think it's good, and it does feel faster. It just doesn't feel that much faster. And the form factor isn't that compelling. I also find that with the black phone, they're calling it Scratchgate now. I spoke about this last week or the week before, last time we were on the show. Anodized materials, the minute they scratch, you're going to see the natural color. So for me, it's all about the white one because the sides, if they get scratched, will be exactly the same as
they were. Yeah, but the white is ugly. So
I mean, you're putting
you're either going to go with potential scratching or just living with. I don't know. I'm not fine with this. I'm reviewing the white one right now. I'm not fond of this coloring right now.
White one. I like the white. Yeah. I like the 4S. I like the white 3GS. I like the white 5.
Yes,
like...
we know.
What do you think? What do you think of the phone in general, Devendra?
Yeah. So I'm actually a really big fan of it. It's definitely not. In many ways, it's not like a night and day difference from the iPhone 4S. But if you look at what Apple is doing, this is, you know, they're basically on a 2-year replacement cycle, and they're working with, they're basically assuming that's how a lot of iPhone owners are going to be upgrading. So either, you know, you're on the line with like the original update, like the iPhone 3G, then the iPhone 4, then the iPhone 5. You know, when your upgrade cycle comes up, these devices come up, or you're on the slightly refreshed one, the S models.
The
S line. When it comes to those owners, I think anybody who owns an iPhone 4 or before should definitely upgrade to this phone. Because I disagree with you, Dwayne. I think the speed is noticeably faster. Infinity Blade 2, a game that took...
4S, you want
well,
to upgrade?
Hold on. Infinity Blade 2 is a pretty hefty, heavy-duty game. On the iPhone 4S, for me, by the time you get past all the loading screens and stuff, and you're waiting from the title screen to the point where you can actually play the game, 20 seconds. iPhone 5? Less than 2 seconds, guys.
Wow.
And some of this may have to do with, you know, just maybe the file system is a little more fragmented on my iPhone 4S. Maybe other things are slowing it down. But there's a definite sense of speed here. There's no more loading for anything. Galaxy Empire 2, which is also a pretty heavy-duty game, you know, a good, fun space game, pretty much no load times. And on the iPhone 4S and iPhone 4, I also remember having to spend a lot of time just for levels to load, things to happen. And this chip, like, if you look at the benchmarks, and Nantech has done quite a few benchmarks, it's fast. It is the fastest mobile chip out there right now. It's only occasionally bested by the iPad's chip. and that's just because it has a better GPU and stuff. But this phone, like, it is ridiculously fast. You feel it when you're opening apps, when you're doing practically anything. And the fact that, you know, we finally have LTE. Mm-hmm. I know it's nothing new. I know Android phones have had it for a while. But it feels like this is LTE done right. Because you get those fast speeds, and mm-hmm. you're not killing your entire battery life. Pretty much every Android phone I had, if I've been using it for like web browsing and Twitter and just simple email tasks, by the middle of the day, my battery is going to be in a bad position, especially if it's an LTE phone. This thing lasts even better or longer than the iPhone 4S did for me. So I can do a full charge in the morning, and then by the night, I haven't even reached the red bar yet, 20%.
I got to disagree with that. The iPhone 5 battery seems no better across the multiple people that we've tested it with in my offices compared to the iPhone 4S battery.
Like, it depends.
We don't even have LTE. We're using AT&T's 4G, and I can say for a fact we tested it, looping it, doing iPhone syncs and everything like that. It, you know, over 15 hours, it doesn't have a better. In actuality, it doesn't, unless your use case is very separate. Like according to all like four or five six use cases that we looked at, we haven't seen any battery life improvement, which is a big deal considering it's an LTE phone. Just like the LTE iPad came out, they had to make it thicker. They made this one thinner, and the battery is the same. So that's a big deal.
The battery is basically the same. It's a higher voltage, slightly higher capacity. But the thing is, like in terms of my usage at least, which isn't – I'm not going through benchmarks. I'm just doing my normal usage. And I'm actually doing a little more, you know, LTE data usage than I would normally. I'm, you know, playing – streaming things over Spotify. I'm doing video just to see how fast this network can be. The battery life is, you know, slightly better, generally maybe about the same as the 4S. But that's the thing, guys. That's not a bad thing. The 4S actually has pretty good battery life for a smartphone.
It does.
And seriously, go look at an Android phone with LTE. You know, you can't count on those things for pretty much anything. And Android phone makers, to basically make up for that fact, I think there's just tons of inefficiencies within Android, within the hardware that's actually used to put these phones together. It's really tough for them to get the battery.
The Droid Razor Max is actually pretty good at battery life.
Because it's a hefty-ass battery.
Well, that's
it's
what I was going to say. Like,
I give it that. I would say, though, that I think for the average user, if the iPhone 5 was as heavy as the iPhone 4S, but the battery like was the reason for that because it was denser or whatever, it would not be a detraction. It would not take away. You wouldn't say, man, this phone's so heavy I can't use it.
I don't know why you're making that argument, because I'm saying this phone is much lighter. It feels significantly lighter, but the battery life, the fact that they were able to keep it basically the same, in some cases better.
And what I'm saying is only that if they had made the battery life even better, but the phone were heavier, that would not have been a trade-off. That would have turned people off. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, that's a weird if, because I'm saying, Dwayne, I'm saying it's not necessarily a problem. That's all. And if you have to look at the competition, right? How is Android fixing this? They're stuffing bigger batteries into these phones.
Phone.
The screens are getting bigger, too.
Apple's not thinking about the competition when they're working on this kind of thing. They're thinking about what they can do for the absolute like best. What's the thing that works for them? That's why they don't do things like use micro USB. So all I'm saying is that if the phone happened to be heavier, but the battery were even longer lived, because of that, if they had focused on that kind of thing, it would probably get even more praise than it does today. I don't think lightness is something that you care about in a telephone if you're an average consumer.
Really? The first thing, you know, anybody picks up this iPhone 5, the very first thing they say is, oh my God, it's so light. And that's actually one of the things that's actually pushing me towards upgrading, even though I have an iPhone 4S, is that, you know, it kind of makes you realize how big or how heavy the iPhone 4 and 4S design was as well. Because that one had glass on both sides.
Right.
Glass is incredibly heavy. Mm-hmm. The 5 is only 20% lighter, but it actually feels pretty significant because you're working with, you know, already kind of vaguely small weights at this point. But, you know, I was looking up some stats. The iPhone 4S and 4 design, you know, they're identical. They weighed a couple grams heavier than the Galaxy S3. The Galaxy S3, guys, has a 4.8-inch screen. The iPhone 4 has a 3.5-inch screen. So it's like that sort of difference is kind of ridiculous. So now with the iPhone 5, like, it's actually an iPhone that has – it feels lighter, but also it's substantial. which is something Android mm-hmm. phones haven't been able to do for me. There really is no all-metal unibody Android phone. Maybe the HTC One series. I think some of those models had a good metal unibody design. But when it comes to, I think, the level of polish and what we're seeing on the iPhone 5, nobody can really compete. So I do think weight makes a big difference, Dwayne. It's all down to the experience. Holding this phone mm-hmm. feels almost effortless. You know, it's like reading, when I'm reading on this thing with the bigger screen and everything, it feels like a paperback. And that's kind of a big deal, especially if you're using it for a lot of stuff.
I feel like the average user would prefer battery life oversized. And when it comes to the Galaxy S3, the phone is made out of plastic and you can bend it. And it's got like a plastic back that pops off. So that's why it's lighter. Beside the iPhone 5, are there any unibody phones out there? Phones that are made?
I think some of the HTC One series, maybe the 1S, not the 1X, because that one has a replaceable battery pack. But they have stronger... I think that 1S is unibody. The Lumias are all unibody because you can't remove those things. Those aren't metal. Those are unibody polycarbonate, but you know, still pretty cohesive. But Dwayne, like seriously, you can't speak for the average user when you're talking about battery life, because we are far from the average users. What I've been doing pretty much over the past weekend, I've been like giving out the phone to people and just seeing how they're reacting. Also looking at like general responses that I'm seeing online too from people. The lightness is noticeable. And the thing is, was the battery life a problem that Apple had to solve? Because you're assuming that, you know, okay, if Apple made the battery life bigger or made it a lot longer, that people would be impressed by that. I'm sure they would. But that was never really a problem with the iPhone 4 design. The real problem was the
iPhone
weight.
4S had battery issues from the moment it was released.
That was a technical issue, though, wasn't it?
It
was perceived as a programmatical issue, but the minute, like, I mean, if you, but it isn't. I mean, I have an iPhone 4S. I've been using an iPhone 4S. It still gets hot. It still has a battery going down. I had it replaced. I mean, it's at a point where you almost wonder, like, is that advantage gone now?
If you want to go a phone with a good battery life, what do you get? Are there any Android phones that even come close that aren't like 8-inch screens?
iPhone 4's battery life is better. It was to me better than the iPhone 4S's battery life.
I feel like, Dwayne, like instead of living with the phone that's getting hot and draining your battery, you may have just gotten another replacement, because they will give it to you for free. I had to do that too. I think I had one of the launch day iPhone 4S units as well. It was a little weird. Like the battery life was just strange. But once I replaced it, and it was fine. It was just the same as the 4 for me. So it wasn't a continued issue. I know a couple other people too. We talked about this on, I think it was the show or the Symbiotic show. Yeah, we talked about it last year. It was potentially an issue, but once like that initial wave of launch stuff, you know, went away and people kind of either got their stuff replaced or fixed or whatever, it wasn't a problem that came back. It was no AntennaGate. Apple never had to come out and say, you know, hey, we have a battery problem with this phone.
No. They figured out the AntennaGate thing. Who even knows that was really, 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 really a problem? My whole point is that when I'm looking at the iPhone 5 or the iPhone 4S, my impressed level of the battery life, and this is not true for just me. It's true for like many people around the digital marketplace I work in. You know, it's not something that we're sitting there impressed with. When we speak about the average user and are they impressed with battery life, you know, they're not when it comes to using their phone for heavy usage day by day, but they are when it comes to the whole thing where I forgot to charge my phone last night, but I'm not worried about it. That's where we see battery life and the average user collide. When the average user is like, I haven't charged my phone last night or whatever, and then their phone is at like, their phone is hanging out at 50% or it you know, doesn't get to some worrisome level, then we know we're in a good space. But when someone forgets their 4S and they're at work at 11 o'clock in the morning and they're at 2%, you know, that's the thing. And obviously that has to do with usage and which apps you're running and all that other stuff like that. But what I'm saying is the battery life awesomeness that I've seen in the 3GS and in the 4, it's perceptually not something that was carried through to the 4S. The 4S has
I disagree. It's really check on the apps that you're using, okay? Because my iPhone 4S, definitely, it can be at 20% when I go to bed. When I get up in the morning, it will not hit the 10% line. Like, that's kind of the key. And that's something, actually, Android phones still can't do. You can't leave an Android phone in standby overnight and not see like a significant amount of battery life just go away. Mm-hmm. That's probably because like Android's doing a lot of background processes. It's, you know, it's fetching more data in the background than the iPhone does. But, you know, with the iPhone 5, I can tell you for a fact that I've done it a couple times. Like, I can see that the battery life is really low when I go to bed and I get up, even if it's under 10%. It could still turn on. It could still do everything. It may not last for a long time. But, you know, the fact that it actually survived the night is enough to, like, you know, give you the alarm clock in the morning if you didn't plug in your phone or something. Those are the important things. So I think for that usage, if you think general people care about that too, I think the iPhone 5 is up there.
I don't know. A lot of people really want bigger phones. I personally don't understand that. Like, I don't actually like a phone that's too big that I can't touch the far corner with my fingers. I'm curious, having actually played with it, like, is it too big? Is it just
right? It's a happy medium. They did the right thing, making it not wider, making it longer. I said it earlier in here, when I'm in the mail app and I go to like move between messages like up and down, it right now it's a bit of a stretch. Literally, it's a bit of a stretch. I'm like, okay, let me slide the phone down a little bit, whatever. Is it a deal breaker? Absolutely not. Is it nice to have the bigger screen so that you have more apps on the first screen, second screen, whatever? Absolutely yes. And the screen itself is just better looking. Like, you can, like, it's still a Retina screen. You're not seeing pixels on the 4S, the 4, or on the iPhone 5. But the colors on the iPhone 5 are clearly better. And when I held it up against the Samsung Galaxy S3 that we have in the office, it was also, you know, impressive compared to that. And that phone's got a pretty good screen.
It's more accurate. So all Samsung screens for their Galaxy series are really saturated. So yep. It looks mm-hmm. like, you know, oh, they're better. Look at the colors. They're really popping. But it's all kind of fake. So that's kind of the deal with that. But yeah, I agree with you, Dwayne. Like, it's a good happy medium between a very big screen and, you know, having something that's portable and easy to use one-handed. Actually, one of the commercials Apple just put out for the iPhone 5 literally just shows, hey, look at what I can do with one hand. I don't have to move my thumb very much. I can still get around the screen. So that's actually kind of funny. The real question, though, is where does Apple go from here? Will we see a 4.3-inch iPhone screen at some point? I don't think Apple will ever get up to 4.5. Like, I think that's pretty much out there. We've seen those screen sizes. Android phones with those big screens are actually getting to be more portable. Like, they feel better in your hand. There's not a lot of bezel around the screen, so you can actually still have a fairly slim and small phone with a big screen. But I think that may be too much. That may be a bit overkill. So I have a theory that actually this mm-hmm. may be the plateau of iPhone design, at least for now, at least until like several years from now, Apple radically changes
for the next
everything.
Two designs.
Beyond the obvious next year's iPhone 5S or whatever.
No, but, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about like this design. Let's call it the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 7. I see them all as being 4-inch screens.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, will they be 4-inch screens after the iPhone 5S? I don't know. I think Apple creeps towards maybe 4.3, maybe 4.2.
It seems weird.
This resolution, the screen resolution, is just below 720p. It's like 11 something by something. 720p is 1280 by 720. So they could conceivably go up to, you know, a 4.3-inch screen, mm-hmm. Be 720p or even slightly higher, and still keep the Retina stuff. But do they need to?
Why not just make it tighter?
Yeah.
Instead of making a bigger phone, they could say, okay, I want to make a 720p screen. I want to make a 1080p screen. I mean, I feel like that's where, to me, that's more important growth than making a bigger device, especially on the cusp of an iPad mini that might be happening.
If it's already Retina, though, no screen advance is really going to make a difference at this size. That's the thing. If this screen is a 330 PPI pixels per inch, which is, you know, yeah, it's undiscernible with the naked eye, even if you
have
very good vision, you know, so it's up there, you know. That's the thing. So it wouldn't help Apple at all to like bump up the resolution at this size. You have mm-hmm. to go bigger to bump up the resolution. The real question is, how long is that going to take? And how long will Apple stick with like this design? They actually can't go much thinner either. Like, this thing is 7.7 millimeters thick, 7.6, which is, it's great. It feels great in your hand. It's almost paperbacky. It feels like you're holding paper. Sometimes it feels like you're not holding much at all. But when it's flat on a table, it's actually getting kind of tough to pick up because your fingers kind of need a certain amount of
right. They'd have to taper to grab it, like the iPod Touch, the new iPod Touch. Mm-hmm. I've played with that too. On a table, I definitely it's easier to pick up the iPod Touch because it's tapered on the sides, much like an iPad is. So that isn't that's something that they could think about doing. When it comes to the actual size and the screen and all, I mean all that stuff, I really feel like making a 1080p phone in like, you know, one or two generations, it solves a couple problems on the media side. You can just have media that's one resolution. You don't have to worry about having to convert it when you're dragging it over. I mean, I'm just saying it doesn't. That's one of those things that those problems will be solved, and they can speak about ever changing resolutions. I really don't think that 4 inches is a. I don't think that 4 inches they're gonna rush away from after the iPhone 5S or the iPhone 6 that they're called those things. I just don't think it's something that they're gonna rush away from. I think we can for the conceivable future. I think through 2015 we'll see the same size of screen at least.
Yeah, and then Apple will probably catch a lot of flack for that. But here's the thing, like, can Apple just survive and stick and keep polishing and iterating this design while Android is slowly getting bigger and bigger? Even those phones kind of have to stop growing after a certain point. The Galaxy Note 2, which I was just playing around with, it's 5.5 inches now, even though it's in the same basic case size as the old Galaxy Note. You know, that sort of thing. So they can't really, not every phone can get that point. I don't think, there are rumors that the next Nexus phone may be a 5-incher. And I think that would be a horrible mistake. I think Android really needs to focus on those devices and maybe kind of start polishing these things down.
HTC, yeah, I feel like Android has been just making devices bigger and bigger because they, mostly I think, because they have to fit giant batteries in them in order to make them decent life. That's my theory.
That's part of it.
You're absolutely right. Battery, and it's the United States car industry idea that bigger is better, right? Yeah. It's going to be bigger car. It's going to be a bigger phone, all that stuff. I really don't think that I think that what's going to happen is, I mean, when you get to the point where the Galaxy, where the Nexus 7, the tablet, is so elegant and so well designed, and Google went smaller on that. The idea that they're going to go bigger on their phones until you have this weird kind of crossover overlap thing, that doesn't make any sense to me. I really think that the only way these phones are going to get bigger is if they become somewhat thinner. There is a point where the average user's hand. You look at a lot of the consumers of these devices. They're like, you know, young women who just want like the right device that's going to fit their like lifestyle, fashion, whatever. They're not going to be able to meet, like, you know, they can't continue to grow them all the time. But Android's strength is that they don't have just one phone. They have several phones. So some manufacturers differentiate by making it bigger. Some differentiate by keeping it relatively small but doing other things. So they have room to do that change. When we talk about Apple's devices, they've got to find a medium that'll hit the average user without making them feel like their phone is like, you know, chintzy or whatever. They want to build quality. They want to have good quality control. And that means that, you know, look at this Retina display glass. They worked on that for, you know, forever in order to get there. And I think that it's really a question of working a bit longer. And determining like what the next big deal is. Is it the size of the phone? Maybe not. Maybe it is things like inductive charging, NFC. Maybe it's the idea that, like, you know, maybe it's going to be some other new idea there. I mean, right now the reason why this phone is not considered the most amazing thing ever is because it lacks some of the qualities that people thought were going to be groundbreaking.
So to summarize here, Apple's the Maps feature on iOS 6 is basically a fiasco. It's solid in some respects, but in other respects, it's all over the place. It's nowhere near as good as Google's previous application. It's got some places it features distorted images, and some major landmarks are gone or shifted in location from where they actually are, a lot of people are wondering why Apple decided to go with their own map application when Google's was working perfectly fine before then. And so essentially, I mean, it's basically they kind of had to do this, didn't they? Because
I don't know if they had to. And let's make something very clear. It's always been Apple. Apple makes the map application. This is a question of what data they're using. Google's data is more robust than TomTom's data. Apple decided to go with TomTom. They decided to go with Yelp and a couple other services.
Right, right. Apple's using a bunch of little TomTom and a whole bunch of other little services.
Well, Let's not. I mean, let's not. Let's throw away these these evaluative things. Apple went with some of the players they knew. TomTom is small compared to Garmin and Google and stuff like that, but Yelp is not small at all. So they decided to kind of cobble together some best in industry, some not so best in industry guys, in order to come up with a mapping set of data that works with how they wanted to take the app's direction. And they were smart to make sure that the app was theirs, and they had licensed the information. We also talked about the YouTube app, another Google data based app that Apple created. In this case, Google's made its own app. Apple has integrated with that app. So it is the default video app when you hit a YouTube link. It doesn't go to Safari and then come over to YouTube. If you have the YouTube app, it goes directly from your mail or whatever to the YouTube app. So Apple is not in a place where they're just kind of dissing Google on all fronts. This YouTube app is Google's, and it is integrated into the operating system, just like they integrated Twitter, just like they integrated Facebook. When it comes to this particular app, though, they did want to take the direction, take the stuff in a different direction, and I think that's where the controversy goes. There is a question of why, and you know, maybe it's business decisions. I mean, it's clearly business decisions, but is it a question of that complete rivalry with Google? Well, I don't think that's
according
the case.
To all
well,
things.
Where's the YouTube app, Dwayne? Where's the YouTube app in iOS 6?
Yeah. I just said that if you download the YouTube,
you have to download it separately.
You have to download a separate one. Yes, yes. But the fact that you know YouTube was removed from iOS 6 kind of at the last minute. And now this, too, like from multiple reports, it sounds like Google didn't think Apple was going to jump on their own maps like right away. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, Apple announced it with iOS 6, I think it was like last July or so, you know, Apple still had like a year left on its contract with Google. They didn't assume it would be changing all that quickly.
The YouTube app, I'm saying, is integrated just the way Facebook and Twitter is. It's the default video app when you hit a YouTube link. It doesn't go to Safari and then jump you to the YouTube app because Google put a thing in there. Apple worked with Google so that if you're in mail and you have a YouTube link in there, it goes directly to the Google app if you have it. If you don't have the app, it'll take you to the website. That's the same way it works with Twitter. There's a Twitter link. Someone links a reference to Twitter in your mail and you hit the link, it'll take you to the website. But if you have the Twitter app, it'll take you directly to the Twitter app. That's kind of how it works. So I don't think it's a question of them saying, like, fuck you on all fronts, Google. I think that they want...
It's not hard to redirect into your OS to properly YouTube links, right? There's no YouTube or Google section in your preferences within your iOS 6 settings, but there is a section for Facebook. There is a section for Twitter. It's kind of clear who Apple wants to buddy up with now, you know, the social services that can't really pose a threat to them. Versus right. Google, which is quickly beginning to dominate in many different ways. You know, Android's continuing to grow. The OS is getting better. Finally, the apps are getting better. It's becoming more of a legitimate quality threat. So it kind of makes sense for, you know, Apple to just say, hey, screw it. The big problem is that, you know, customers are kind of left blindsided and kind of left struggling. I'm not sure if Apple realized just how many issues they'd have with these mapping systems. There was a couple good posts by some mapping experts who were like, yeah, Apple pretty much underestimated how difficult this whole problem would be.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, it may come down to the fact that Apple isn't a data company. You know, Google is a data company. Google knows how to get a huge chunks of data, how to analyze it, how to turn that into something usable by users. Apple knows how to make things pretty. For sure. I mean, that's what we saw when they first showed off the iOS 6 maps. These 3D flyovers, these 3D buildings are really pretty. And they are.
When they work.
When they work. When they work and when they can accurately find things. So it's a problem. It's annoying. It's definitely not big enough, by the way, that I would tell people not to get an iPhone 5 for it. And maybe not even not to upgrade to iOS 6. Like, you can still use the Google Maps web app, and there are other improvements in iOS 6 that I think are kind of worth having.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, it's been a little bit different using iOS 6 maps, but overall, I'm actually pretty happy with using
the
iOS 6 maps.
The turn-by-turn directions are great, yeah.
Now, granted, I'm in Apple's backyard, so right. I'm sure that it has probably the best data in the world for it.
That
but
has
still,
a lot to do with it.
It's not... I don't know. My experience has not been as overwhelmingly devastating as the internet might have you believe.
It definitely does depend on where you are. Here in New York City, some simple things like subway locations, subway station locations on the map itself aren't there because Apple doesn't have that data. which is ridiculous, guys. It's it's kind of like as important as a street address or a street name. And it's just not on the map. It's nowhere to be found. And it's now we're also relying on third-party apps also for public transit directions. That could ultimately be a good thing. But right now, at the beginning, it's really rocky. Not all the apps are very there's finally one that I've kind of settled on. But it's kind of a shame that things aren't as seamless as they used to be.
You might say that, okay, so like they're missing a couple stations. Chris talked about how he's in Apple's backyard.
Missing every station.
I did an actual test this weekend. I was in New York State. I flew into the city for my friend's wedding. I was there for like 40 hours. I had to drive from the city up into to Hunter Mountain in upstate New York, the Catskills. And I had my girlfriend's iPhone 3GS with iOS 5.11, and I had my iPhone 4S with iOS 6. And iOS 6 was an absolute disaster. 4.5 hours to get to a place that should have taken 3 hours because their directions were absolutely awful. The turn-by-turn was absolutely awful. It was a terrible experience. In fact, there got to a point where we basically, like, you know, after 3 hours and we realized we were still so far away, I broke out the Google directions and we got there. And you know what? On the way home, I used the MapQuest app, which has turn-by-turn directions, and it worked seamlessly, perfectly. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are options. TomTom has always been relatively shitty. If Apple had made the deal with Garmin, it would have been a better experience. But what Apple's going to do here, and I guarantee this is what's happening, is that TomTom's points of interest, TomTom's information, it's going to get updated in a very, very quick way because of Apple, because of iOS 6 adoption, because of iPhone 5 purchasing. So their data and feedback, the feedback loop that they create, is going to upgrade this stuff in a huge way. And that's what happened with Google. Google's maps only got better as they spent more time looking at iOS devices and how that data was being used. They were able to use it. And obviously, like DaVinci said, you could still use the web app. The web app doesn't always work the way many people would like it to. But the bottom line is that like iOS 6's maps, they simply don't cut the mustard when it comes to you having like a mission critical feature of an operating system. Because when you're in the car and you're doing your turn by turn and it's telling you you've got to make a U-turn 4 times in a row, it's fucked up. And that's what it did in like New York State. You know, not in like the complete boonies. Hunter Mountain is, you know, there's a town, you know, it has a whole situation. People go up there all the time. It's one of the most popular mountains in New York State. Boom. It was terrible.
Can Apple overcome this, particularly on a global scale, or do they just not have the resources that Google does?
Well, Apple had a better – I've looked at some of this stuff, and Apple's actually done – the maps work better in China, apparently, according to what I've been reading, than they did before. So on a global scale, it's unclear because I'm sure certain places – TomTom's got better data in certain places than Google had. You know, that might be a situation. TomTom's selling devices over there that Google just isn't. So that's a thing. But I think in terms of there's a PR debacle, and will Apple get over it?
For sure. I mean, here's the thing: is Apple is notorious for having the image of putting the customer experience first, and this was one of those cases where they absolutely fucked up in that respect. They put their own interests first before the consumer experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, Flyover is not better than Street View. If I'm looking for an address and I look up Street View on my 3GS with 5.11, I know what I'm looking for when I get there. That's the building. That's exactly what I'm looking for. Flyover, I mean, how many times have you guys been in a helicopter just wanting to find that one building? I mean, that
it's a fun thing, yeah, but it has no real practical use for me, at least. I do like the 3D mapping, though. The 3D mapping is kind of cool. I just wish other bits of it actually work.
Super fun. I feel like that has some value in terms of like trying to find where things are.
Yeah, yeah. The 3D mapping is actually pretty good, especially if you're in like a crazy block in New York and you can't see the streets or something. You can see the buildings as landmarks. And that bit of it, I think, is kind of fun.
I mean, Google Earth is pretty good at 3D mapping.
No, not the same.
See, you know, I have to admit,
have you really looked at the 3D maps?
Yeah, I'm saying the concept here is awesome. The execution is janky, and the execution will get better. But I've never been as disappointed as I have been here. And I was like, okay, fine, it'll be fine. But he's like, don't even upgrade. No, wait till you get to the wedding. Don't wait because you're going to have to get in the car. It's like, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Man, was I a laughingstock because of these maps.
The bright news on the horizon is that Google may have their own dedicated app on the iPhone once again, according to Eric Schmidt, who basically said that it's Apple's it's up to Apple to approve it, and if so, then they'll move forward and get that app in.
It's that's actually a report, I think, is what it sounds like, because that was from, when was that, like Sunday or Friday or something? The more recent news is that Apple or Google is still kind of working on the app, and we probably won't see it until like the end of the year, mm-hmm. but soon.
Talk a bit.
Yeah.
Can I just say, as much as this is a debacle and everything, I am a little bit happy just stepping back for a moment. I mean, for the actual product, it's certainly a mistake. But I am glad to see something happening in the map end, because, I mean, this is one of our long-standing themes on Symbiotic and then here, is that, like, when a single entity controls a market entirely, you don't get competition, you don't get, you know, a great deal of, you know, real push to sort of, like, be innovative and do cool things. And, like, Google has just sort of so overwhelmingly dominated the maps market that, like, I mean, it's not to say that Google is not doing a good job with maps. I just get excited when I see competition start to heat up, because it means that the forerunner who has all the resources has a reason to continue putting those resources and not cutting back. And mm-hmm. somebody else has the, you know, desire to add cool new features and do cool new things with the app maps to do it. Yeah. I don't know. And whether or not it's Google or Yahoo,
Bing.
Or some third party, you know, that steps in and like really dominates here. Either way, I think it's a good opportunity, sort of, for the market to see, you know, Apple starting to entrench on Google's turf. Because, you know, it's good to have competition.
Yeah,
so.
If there's one good thing that could come up from all of this is that, yeah, potentially Google will step up how it approaches maps on iOS. Mm-hmm. Google will have to fight back. I love Microsoft's little comments today. They're like, hey, guys, we got maps too. Don't forget about us.
That's Microsoft should stand for Me Too a song.
You know, but though Microsoft's maps are actually pretty good.
They're all right.
I don't know. I think that the thing here is that because it's the default application, it's going to get a lot of play. That it's clear. But I would say that MapQuest, in terms of turn-by-turn directions, has been doing a good job for at least a year now. Has mm-hmm. been doing a very good job with turn-by-turn for free. Free 99 turn-by-turn directions.
Free 99.
Yeah,
it's fine. Waze is also really good. I really like Waze because it's also like socially driven turn by turn directions. So if like there's traffic or if like there's an accident, people using the app, and there are tens of millions of them at this point, will post those updates there. So you have like great mapping data and also great live data too.
What is this called?
Waze. W-A-Z-E.
W-A-Z-E.
They're in your neighborhood, I think.
Everything's in my neighborhood.
They're huge.
Yeah. Waze is a very good system. I mean, the way Google got its data was based on your GPS. So when you use Maps, it basically says the terms of service that you guys just clicked through, but that I actually read, says, you know, your aggregated anonymous information regarding your GPS coordinates, you know, will be utilized by Google for certain services. And one of those services is the way that Google determines where the traffic is, and it's highly effective. Basically, as you're traveling on a road, if your GPS blip slows down, then that's how it does it. I find that, you know, Microsoft has reasonable maps. Apple's using the same technique for their traffic situation, all that stuff. What I do find nice about the new Maps app is that the functionality isn't very different from the old Maps app in terms of how you get to places. You don't have to look for things again. There's not a lot of stuff there's not a big learning curve here because Apple has dealt with the UI on both sides. So I found that was pretty nice, I gotta say. Okay. I do wish they were smart enough to download the entire route like so that you don't have to look for it when you're out of a reception area.
I do believe that Devendra's got to go now. So Devendra, where can we find you when you're not here on the show?
Sure, you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I write about Tech Adventure Beat every day, and I podcast about movies and TV at slashfilm.com.
All right, cool. Well, we'll see you around. Thanks for joining us, and hopefully we'll get a little bit more of you on our next episode.
Yes, yes. Later, guys.
All right, see ya.
Bye.
So, are we wrapped up there on maps then?
I think so. I mean,
yeah.
All right.
It's definitely a debacle. It's not the worst thing ever.
All right, let's go around the table here, and we already got Devendra, and I'll start with you, Dwayne, and ask you, where can we find you online when you're not here on the show?
You can hit me up at twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also check me out on Google Plus, G+TO/DwayneD, and you can check out everything I do on flavors.me/DwayneD, DWAYNED.
And how about you, Chris? Where can we find you online?
You can find me most often on Twitter at Chris Burnor, CHRISBURNOR. And then I co-curate the best startup-related events and reading lists at startupdigest.com. And, well, you can normally find my blog at chrisburnor.com, but it's sort of undergoing an upgrade, and I haven't had a chance to work on it in a while. So that's a little bit thin at the moment.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, G+.TO/MrBabyMan. You can check out all the past episodes of The Drill Down, all the past 249 episodes, since this is episode 250 of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to geeksofdoom.com and look for our little banner in the upper right-hand corner. Our show is on Stitcher. You can listen to us on your iPhone, your Android phone, your Kindle Fire, and other devices by going to Stitcher.com, Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of these stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that are a wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.